America, we are endowed by our Creator with certain unalienable rights, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. At Grand Canyon University, we believe in equal opportunity, and the American dream starts with purpose. To serve others in ways that promote human flourishing and create a ripple effect of transformation for generations to come. Find your purpose at Grand Canyon University. Private, Christian, affordable. Visit gcu.edu.
Hey folks, and welcome to Typology, the show in which we explore the mystery of the human personality through the lens of the Enneagram. I'm Anthony Skinner. Hey, we continue our fantastic lineup of guests this week with the amazing Amanda Lindsay Cook. She is a singer-songwriter, worship leader. She has won the GMA Dove Award for Inspirational Album of the Year, and she has received three Covenant Awards from GMA Canada, including Female Vocalist of the Year, Song of the Year, and Praise and Worship Song of the Year for her song, You Make Me Brave. Her latest release is House on a Hill, and it is amazing, and she is amazing, and she is actually a really good friend, and you are in store for something special. She is an Enneagram 5, and she has done her work and beautifully wrapped her words around her experience as a 5, so you are in for a treat. Hey, that's it for me, Anthony Skinner, and now, here is Amanda Lindsay Cook with the host of our show, Ian Cron.
Amanda, welcome to Typology.
Thanks for having me.
So we just had a moment.
We sure did. I won't be able to recover.
All right, for context, everybody, Amanda arrived. Oh boy, I wish we'd videoed this.
Yes, that would have been good.
Right? Yeah. We're going to pretty soon be videoing all of our interviews.
Oh, amazing. And then
having a YouTube channel so people can just watch. Because oftentimes, watching the interview is as revealing as just listening.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe more so because you're actually seeing the body language, mm-hmm. the facial cues and that are very unique to each type, mm-hmm. right? So we just had one of those moments where we, a four's favorite moment, when we together experience something that accelerates us into an emotional space that most people can't get to in 10 years. Yes. So we were talking, we discovered that we had a mutual love for choral music. Mm-hmm. And I relate a story about the Estonian composer Arvo Pärt, and a piece of his called The Agnus Dei. And for those of you who've never heard it, A-G-N-U-S, next word, Dei, D-E-I. Arvo Pärt, P-A-R-T is his last name. And I said, oh my gosh, we got to listen to it. It's only 2 minutes. And then what happened?
Well, I'm still working it out in my mind, but I feel like we were all in the car with you on the way to Chicago, as mm-hmm. you described it. I was there. I was in the car. And at a minute 37, was
yeah,
it?
Yeah, at a minute 37.
That's where I want you actually to describe this more for me so that I can listen back to this moment that you just described the root note to me. And that made sense of all the music that I have a gravitational pull towards.
Interesting.
And that I feel like I write around. In fact, so much so that one of my friends who was teaching me how to use studio equipment a couple of years ago, every time he would come over, I would have music like that playing where there's just a strong presence of, and then absence, and then presence and absence. But I love the push and pull of that. And he was like, one of these days I'm going to come over and you're just going to have a person playing a cello the entire day, like a drone in the background. I was like, that is exactly how I would like this sonic track of my life to be perceived, is that one note that grounds everything and then lifts off, and grounds everything and lifts off, kind of the gravity of it. But I want to hear you describe it again, because it kind of made sense of
everything that I
loved within studying classical music and studying piano and doing all the theory courses and everything. Like, it all came back to that one note every time. And I love counterpoint for that reason.
Yes.
Because it's the relationship of counter melodies that move within each other rather than a stacked kind of harmonic chord that follows each other.
Right.
It's more of a relationship. It's more intuitive. It's more felt, at least to me, the counterpoint of it. But anyways, please just describe what you just described to me, because I'm geeking out over it.
like any good five, right? Mm-hmm. We just connected it at such a good space.
Oh, yeah,
right?
And I just had the panic of like, oh, I should have been recording that, or I should have written it down. I need him to repeat it. Right. I need to look it up now. Please indulge me.
Yeah. Well, so this Estonian composer, contemporary sacred music, he's it's this sort of Eastern sort of harmonic, mm-hmm. which is different than Western, right? Obviously. You start with these dominantly two voices dancing around each mm-hmm. other in counterpoint. It's exquisite. Agnus Dei is the Lamb of God who takes away the sins of the world. Have mercy on us, etc. And what people may or may not notice is that there's a drone running through the whole piece, right? It's mm-hmm. one note. And you hear it sometimes in Celtic music, like with bagpipes mm-hmm. or something like this. And it runs, and mm-hmm. everything around it is in relationship to that one note. Well, there's an internal logic to the music, right? Like mm-hmm. in architecture, if you go into a church, what people don't realize is that the architecture itself is theology. It's doing theology. And it's doing theology on you, whether you're aware of it or not, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And that was the mindset of those architects and builders, was that this building is not just a utilitarian space. It ain't a Sam's Club that's been repurposed to be a worship center. The building right. itself communicated great truths about God. And actually, I won't go too far down this path.
Feel that's free good. To edit no. it.
But interestingly, you could sort of draw a timeline or sort of a historic investigation of how did we get from cathedrals to Sam's Clubs?
Oh my gosh.
And what does it tell us? What does our Sam's Club tell mm-hmm. us about our theological understanding of God versus a cathedral? It's not good news, actually.
It's not.
How do we go from, you know, King's College, Cambridge, to a megachurch inside of a box that actually prides itself on being in maybe a former commercial space, rehabbing, whatever? So the thing about the music, sorry for my little...
Please don't apologize. I just finished reading that part in your book.
Oh, my gosh. That's right. It isn't Jason Francis.
This morning.
But the Eson isn't. So that drone that runs through the whole piece of music... actually, I think it was Arvo Pärt who called it the Eson. And the Eson means eternity note. Mm. So what that drone that runs through the whole piece means is it's the presence of God in the world and in the music. It's always there. Whether you're your conscious or unconscious mind is aware of it. But it's always there. And what it does is it doesn't... The other notes that are flying around are not restricted by the presence. Actually, they're freed because the ground of all being is there always. So all the notes then are free to be themselves and to fly around the drone. And then the composer chooses periodically to pull the drone out, what it does is to remind us of what's it like to live in the silence or the now no longer felt presence of God. No longer felt presence. Doesn't mean it's absent. Just means it's... Mm-hmm. You could say that, okay, this is getting too intense, but that what we feel is the presence of God through his absence.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Mm. Yes.
You see that? So again, I love this because we just tend to think that we talk about God in music, but actually great music reveals... Great. The music itself is theology. It's communicating something about God. Forget mm-hmm. the lyrics. Forget the production. Forget mm-hmm. what is the music itself mm-hmm. saying?
Yeah.
Through tension.
Yeah.
Like, why do you end a song on a four chord?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
Because we're not home yet.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's yeah. a theological idea.
Yeah.
Why do we use suspended chords?
Yeah.
Five suspended one. What is it telling us? It's dying to go home. Back to one. Right?
Oh, man.
So yeah. Anyway, now I'm geeking out on. And
no,
my audience,
please don't do
the whole,
that. That's
the whole
amazing.
Typology audience is going, when are we getting to that interview again?
No, this is it. This is the interview. This is what I signed up for this morning. This is exactly what I was hoping.
Anyway, oh so we had a moment, people, and it was really, really beautiful. All right. short introduction from you about who you are, what you're about, what you're doing in the world.
Oh, geez.
And you're an Enneagram 5.
Yay! I am. Woo-hoo! Yes.
We love having yes. Enneagram 5s on. So do our 5s.
Yeah, I know, right?
Instagram is going to light up, man. All the 5s right. are going to be like, thank you.
That is exactly it. We like to wear our invisibility cloaks and we show up every now and again, but, you know, that's exactly it, isn't it? I feel very excited to be here. What do you want to know?
Well, tell people what you do and what gets you up in the morning and what are you thinking about when you go to bed at night?
Oh, geez. Okay. What wakes me up in the morning? Well, there's a present day answer and then there's a more long-term answer. I would say the long-term answer is the endless possibilities. I love infinite possibility. Which would probably be a good name for God for 5s, I think, is to dwell in the land of infinite possibility and you know, quantum physics. As just a tiny deep dive into it, I don't feel well versed in it, but where everything is infinite possibility and under watchful observation, it becomes matter. Energy turns to matter. And I just love that concept. So I would say that is a thing that pulls me out of bed every morning because I really do love to sleep. So the option A is like stay in bed, think your thoughts, you know, order Postmates, text a few friends so you feel like you're part of a community, and then call it a day. It's like really good. So like actually the action of getting out of bed, I would say, takes a lot of concerted effort for me. But that would be one thing that gets me out of bed, I would say, is the infinite possibility and the invitation into that every day. Mm-hmm. Feels pretty new. Feels new and it feels as old as the hills, I think. It feels grounding and good to be part of something that exists far beyond and also deep within and pulls me in a gravitational sort of way, like throughout kind of the ether, I guess. So that probably wakes me up in the morning. And then going to bed is a bit more difficult because I feel like I've waded through a lot of negotiations in my mind during the day of like, what needs to be done? What do I have to do? I kind of move very slowly, extremely slowly. If you know, picture the slowest person you can ever imagine in your mind, times that by probably 4 and you're kind of on point. So I move very slowly through the day. I kind of only do one thing at a time. And then when I kind of get through, like I wade through the, you know, the things that need to get done. And at night when everything settles down and dies down, it's kind of when I feel like bright eyed. So that's usually when a lot of writing or thinking writing gets kind of done. I try to practice Julia Cameron's style of morning pages, which is, you know, to access the subconscious mind, which is always really helpful for me.
The Artist's Way, for people who aren't familiar with The Artist's Way. It's a good book for aspiring artists and artists who are on the journey already.
Yeah, I think the spiritual practice of writing really helps to see it on the page. But at night, I would say I feel very inspired, and so I end up usually staying up a bit later than I would like to. But it kind of depends. The last couple of years, I haven't really had a daily expected rhythm because I've been kind of nomadic. And so I'm excited to get into my rhythm because I just got a place in LA. So I'm very excited.
Ooh.
Excited about very simple things like buying pots and pans and daily tiny rhythms of this is when I do this. This is when I go here. This is when I sit and think my thoughts. This is when I read. This is when I interact with people, you know, things like that.
So would you say your life's compartmentalized?
Yes.
So this is when I do this. This is when my energies go here.
Yeah.
This is when my energies go here. Because it's a very 5 thing.
Yeah. And transitions take forever. Sometimes the transition is the thing. Like moving from one thing to the next.
It becomes
the
thing in and of
itself. It's actually the thing. Like I look forward to actually when I leave an event and get in my car and drive to whatever's next. And I'll take the long way around on purpose, put on a great choral piece of music. Like the transition of moving from one thought to the other or one person to the other, because I really want to get, I mean, in the practice of embodiment, because I have been so dissociated, you know, to be present with people is such a gift, and it takes me a while to really land there. So long that sometimes I feel like I meet people and then I walk away being deeply impacted, and then about 6 months later I realize how impactful that really was. It just takes a long time for things to catch up. So yeah, transitions take a while.
So it sounds like the transition is both a sort of a charging station.
Yeah. Oh yeah. Oh right? Yeah.
Between
Absolutely.
Two events that may have been depleting because it involved a lot of relationship stuff.
Yeah.
But I love that you're also getting ready not to defend yourself against the next encounter, but to actually become open and available to what's coming next.
Yeah. That is my hope. That is my hope, to actually walk into a space and have the defenses down and just actually be present to the gift of the person in front of me, the experience in front of me, whatever is right there.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
I love that, because many times how fives are painted, and actually how some fives are, right, is a little bit like, how do I recharge in order to move back into the world? It's negatively framed. It's like, how do I go back into the world with enough energy to maintain my defenses against depletion?
Right.
Against too many demands being placed against my limited resources. But I love what you're saying, which is like, it's actually quite a monastic idea, which is, how do I go into solitude that I might emerge available for community?
Right. That would be the hope too, because I very much resonate with what you're saying. Previously about, defenses, that feels very true to me. But I think with integration, the best friends that I have are the people that I can be alone together with, I guess, where, you can check in and feel the presence of a person, which is glorious. But when we don't have, when there's nothing being asked or required, or it sounds very luxurious, but it's more about energy than it is anything. It's not about running errands or doing something or serving someone. It's not about that. It's just about the energy resources.
Right.
And I think when we accept the fact that we will be depleted, my resistance ends to it. I go into an environment knowing depletion isn't bad or good. It just is. And we all have a certain kind of measure of energy. So if I accept that before I go in, then I'm not railing against the idea of I'm being drained, I'm being depleted. It's more like, oh, this energy is going somewhere, hopefully in a beautiful way, in an exchange with a person. Like, that's good energy depletion. And at the end of it, I have my fail-safe routine where I get to go back and restore my soul. It's just not, I'm not at the mercy of, I think that's something, I lived in a victim state for a really, really long time, feeling like I was at the mercy of whatever happens next, which would cause me to just completely retreat into the attic of my mind, because I felt like I was always...
Ooh, the attic of my mind! Oh, boom!
So I think learning, it's a hard thing to remember, it's something I feel like I have to practice, but I lived in such a place... If I live in reaction in my victim of I'm at the mercy of whatever happens next or whatever somebody wants from me, then I'll just stay away from most people, most interactions, and stay in bed and order Postmates and read my books. That's like heaven to me. But when I'm not at, when I come to my right mind and realize I'm not at the mercy of something, then I get to decide. It's a powerful decision to go out, be part of something, and share in an energetic exchange with a good boundary in place of, I get to return to the sanctuary of my soul at the end of the day. I get to I look forward to it, but it doesn't mean I'm just trying to survive something in order to say I went to the thing so that I can get to my sanctuary. It's more of a sacred rhythm of, now is when we do this. We have this exchange, we have this whatever this is, and I actually enjoy the ride of it more. I enjoy the spontaneity of not really knowing what's going to happen, because I know at the end of it, I'm like, I can get into my car, put on my music, go for the little drive home, and be a little hermit for however long it takes. Sometimes it's just an hour. Like, time is irrelevant. It's more like, I think, the fear, or the fear that I won't have enough time, that makes any amount of time feel like not enough time. Right. Mm-hmm. But if I'm like, I'm going to just take the time that I need, and then sometimes I'm like, oh, within an hour, I'm like, hey, you know what? I actually want to go out into the world. I want to go, you know, experience.
Right. It sounds like people. It's like when you encounter the world, it's not depletion so much as energy well spent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then you come back and you recharge, and by accepting what is, you don't waste energy on resistance.
Right.
Which is sort of a lovely thing, right?
Yeah.
So when did you kind of figure out you were an Enneagram 5, an investigator, sometimes called the observer? Mm. When did you figure that out? And what did that sort of illuminating fact, how did it affect your self-concept or and your understanding of the world and your history and everything else?
It continues to. I'd say probably when my invisibility cloak wore thin. that's when I discovered I was a five. you know, I think necessity is a great innovator. Isn't that a phrase that we use? And it was very much a necessary step forward in my spiritual path and pilgrimage to help make sense of, I think, just my experience in relationships. Relationships are everything. Relationship to God, to self, to people. My prominent relationship at the time was coming apart, and I was very much in a victim state. So I needed all the help I could get. I think that necessity like pushed me over the edge of whatever I need to learn, however I need to grow, whatever I need to read, but not just read. I mean, we can get stuck reading for days, but actually put into practice. That's where, the floodgates kind of opened.
So the Enneagram gave you language, understanding of maybe what had happened in the relationship previously in your life, mm-hmm. and the lights, like the,
yeah.
the
oh,
tumblers
yeah.
dropped, right?
Yeah,
in the lock. A
yeah,
bit.
And I mean, our community and my closest friends were all kind of on the. We all kind of stumbled into it a little bit together, I'd say. So it gave a lot of context and community and language for, you're not crazy. Right. Oh, I'm right. not crazy. I have felt like such an outsider for so long in my own body and my own experience, and you wow. know, but that, and I used to think, oh, it's the external things. It's the people out there that exaggerate it. Like even thinking that I was just really, really introverted, which I am, but I think that was kind of a smokescreen, because when you go out with people and you're not at home within yourself, you just end up feeling more lonely than mm-hmm. staying at home by yourself. Mm-hmm. Staying at home by yourself, you can fill the space and the silence with like measures of connection that make us feel like we're part of something without actually having to engage in the world. But when we engage in the world and we're already really lonely and we aren't at home within ourselves, and it just exaggerates the loneliness.
So three times you just alluded to not at home in my own body.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
And that's a very five thing.
Oh yeah.
So I want you to describe, what does that mean? Not disembodied, not at home in my own body. You all, earlier in the conversation, you talked about dissociating, which is, you know, not dissimilar to that theme.
Yeah.
What are you talking about there? Because some people won't understand what it means to feel not at home in your own body.
Oh, geez. I would say it feels a bit like everything is moving. It's almost like watching a film of your own experience
mm-hmm.
above, and everything feels like it's moving too fast to ingest and to really take in.
Yes. Engulfment is what we say sometimes in psychology with fives. It's this feeling of life is engulfing and it's too much, and I can't, my processor can't keep up.
Yeah.
With everything coming at me.
100%. 100%. Yeah. Mm. It feels a bit like watching something happen. And I mean, there's like actually reading about the five and realizing, you know, the feelings come later. They're mm-hmm. latent. I mm-hmm. used to feel like, why am I just broken? Like I rarely feel things right in the moment. they just get stacked up, and then 6 months later, I'm like, oh, this is how I feel about something. But I would say the feeling outside my body, it's a pretty regular thing. And then there's practices that are suggested for us, like dancing, mm-hmm. which I think is a human expression that we're all deeply in need of, you know, because that puts me in the moment like nothing else. So I'd say that's deeply healing, and it's an integrating, I think, practice.
Yes. Yoga's great.
Oh my gosh. I love it. I love it.
There's a passage in James Joyce has a beautiful collection that's actually readable from called Dubliners is the name of it. It's so beautiful. And in it, he describes a character. He said, Mr. Duffy lived a short distance from his body.
It's like a little bird above the shoulder of a human frame. That's how I feel like my soul is. It's just kind of like floating up there and saying, oh, that's interesting every once in a while. What an interesting thing to observe.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. You have those amazing powers of observation as a fox. You almost approach life like an investigative journalist.
Yeah.
And you're kind of, but the danger, of course, is that you confuse thinking with participating.
Yep, absolutely. Absolutely.
Right. Yep. And so how are you learning to actually dive into life and participate in it versus observing it from a distance and confusing that with life?
Right. It's a good question. Again, I feel like necessity. It pulled me to the vulnerable edges of all that I was trying to guard, I guess, or trying to guard against, and put me in the path of people, which are flawed and wonderful and beautiful. But that was more healing than anything else. I have a memory of sitting with friends in LA last summer. We were sitting around a dinner table. We had a long dinner, and this family they're just precious to me. They're like siblings. We had a long dinner together, and there was wine, and there was music, and there was singing, and there was spontaneous dancing. And at one point, we were all sitting around the table, candles were lit, a song came on. I think it's called "We Don't Need to Argue Anymore" by the Cranberries.
Oh yeah. Uh-huh.
And I burst spontaneously into tears. And in that moment, it felt, I just felt like this little voice, like, stay. Like, I didn't leave in my mind. I just stayed. And we all just stayed. And two of my friends just, like, it's weird to, I haven't really described this out loud, but I felt like I stayed in my body rather than, like, I'll take my tears into the attic of my mind and disappear there and then return back. Because I can do that in a moment, even when I'm with people. Mm. Like, I'll disappear for a second, go and try to find a book in my bookcase up there somewhere in the attic, and then return when I have something to say. This was just like, I had nothing left. So it's glorious. Like, I think it feels like crashing, and it feels like a symphony at the same time. And they were, like, one of my friends just reached across the table and put her hand on my hand, and one had her hand on my shoulder, and then my other two friends just sat there, tears, and we just sat in silence for the whole song. And then when the song ended, whatever's next was whatever's next. It just happened. It was a moment that I was actually fully alive to and fully present in, and it was deep solidarity, I think, which is incredibly healing. Just the deep solidarity of not somebody imposing ideas or thoughts or it's okay, or, you know, trying to make things okay. It was just clearly not okay. I was in a not okay year. Last couple of years have just not been okay. And it was amazing to sit in the, this is not okay. It's a not okay year. We're just all going to not be okay with it. And that's glorious. So I don't even know if that answers anything. I think the practice of actually being with people, and it is an interior practice of staying with, like, those moments of just staying in the moment rather than, like, retreating and going to get a book or a thought or whatever and come back. And by then it feels like I've taken a trip around the room, you know, and things have kept moving down here, but I don't know yet.
So interestingly, before we began, we listened to that piece of music, and I was standing on the other side of the room near the speakers because I have this tendency to conduct when I hear music like that. But as I looked over and saw you looking down and tearful, mm-hmm. and I was like, interesting, because oftentimes fives don't like to be surprised by emotions. Yeah. They don't like it when they well up on their own and overtake them.
Yeah.
There's a lot of fear about that, and they can retreat. But so what was going on for you when you, for you as a five, tears arise, you don't know me. Yeah, this is the first time we're meeting, though it feels like we know each other now. What was happening there? What was it like for you? Was it uncomfortable? Was it natural? What?
No, I mean, we don't know each other, but it's that I've been reading Chasing Francis all week, and not because I knew I was going to meet you, but because one of my dear friends said, this book changed my life. I think it's right on point for exactly where you're at. And I just started reading it that night and haven't been able to put it down. So then when this came together, I was like, oh my God, this is, I feel very known when I read, you know, experiences and stories and thoughts like that. I feel very safe maybe with the author of who's admitting themselves on the page, because you've done the work of admission. So it feels safe. For years and years, though, I would just collect that and think about it later, which, I mean, there's just a measure of that that's going to happen later on. I'll probably talk about this with my friend Melissa in 2 days, and we'll be on a walk in the forest in North Carolina, and I'll be recalling this to her. And then about a week after that, I'll be thinking about the walk in the forest and probably be talking to someone else about that.
It's just lily padding across your life.
You know, it's like the last week's, oh, wow, this is amazing, you know? But I think for years and years, I stored up emotion and I did not know how to express it except through music. And even in my family, they feel things deeply and they cry a lot easier than I do. And I remember my dad, even when I was a kid, being like, you can let it out. You can let it out what you feel. And I did not know how to, in my body. I knew how, the only place I really found that kind of home was in music, was in playing it, was in piano. But I think over the last couple years, all those kind of guards just kind of came down a bit. And it's still a practice to decide to let the waves of emotion actually happen, because I think I get afraid that I'll be swept away by them or I'll drown there, rather than letting it wash and cleanse and heal. And, you know, we can only really heal what we're willing to feel anyways. So
say that again.
We can only heal what we're willing to feel.
Can you say that again?
We can only heal what we're willing to feel.
That's an amazing statement.
Wow, that's a really great quote to go out on. We can only heal what we're willing to feel. I'm so glad that Ian asked her to repeat that a few times. Hey, I hope you enjoyed part one of our two-part series with Amanda Lindsay Cook. Be sure and tune in next week for part two. And until next week, we hope you have a good one. See ya.